Hunger that persuades to evil. Virgil. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week. I appreciate the support. If you're a newcomer, welcome. I hope you will enjoy and will decide to peruse our backlog of episodes. And if you're a returning listener, thank you guys as always. Your support, again, means a lot to me. So please rate, like, download, sub, 5 stars, all that kind of good stuff to kind of keep the show growing and showing up in the algorithm and all that kind of good stuff. So I was debating and thinking about it after last week's episode, but I think before covering the rest of France, we really should finish talking about the linear pottery culture, or the linear bond ceramic, aka the LBK. I know it's been a couple of months since they were introduced when we were talking about, you know, regions bordering on the Balkans. And I don't want to let it get even further out, because there's a lot kind of tied into that. So we're going to talk about the LBK and how it finally disappears. And then we're also going to go over and at least introduce their successor cultures, at least in the areas outside of the ones we've already covered that topic on. And several of their successor cultures exist for fairly long periods. So we will, you know, we will at least introduce them. And depending on how long they're around, we may go into a little bit more detail. Otherwise, we might just kind of talk about their earliest beginnings and leave, you know, kind of the in-depth dive on them until next season. So we'll kind of have to play it by ear. But I want you guys to remember that the LBK, this is the culture that initially emerged a little to the north of where the Danube begins to kind of turn south and flow into the Balkans. So right on that kind of, if you think about a map of Europe today, kind of right on the southern border of Austria, Hungary, Slovenia, all those kind of areas. And once they had established themselves kind of in that little heartland along the Danube, they began to quickly expand both east and west. Though, as we discussed prior in the Balkan episodes, its eastern sites disappeared much earlier. In some cases, just a few centuries after they emerged. And then those eastern sites merge or evolve into other Eastern European Neolithic cultures, like the Tisza Pulgar or the Cucuteni Tripolier culture, which we've already discussed a little bit, at least with the Cucuteni. The Tisza Pulgar, we've kind of already filled in most of their characteristics that show up there. But Cucuteni Tripolier we'll return to. So kind of a similar situation with some of the sites we'll see in the West as well with the other LBK successor cultures. We'll also talk about some of the cultures bordering them to the north, because that's going to set up another region that we have to cover, and that's kind of Scandinavia, Denmark, Norway, Switzerland, and some kind of neighbors to the ceramic cone culture, which I believe we covered, but I'm going to double check that to make sure that that's all kind of included in this season. But that's going to take place after we return to France. So there's going to be a little bit back and forth between these regions, but I just want you guys to, you know, kind of have an idea of where we're going and what we're looking at. Now, some of these offshoots of the LBK emerge fairly, you know, fairly early, but they don't really kind of expand. And they're still connected through trade and things like that with the, I guess you would call it the classical LBK culture. Just to kind of remind you of their footprint, they moved up the Danube in what is now modern-day Germany, southern Poland, Bohemia is the medieval name for it, but like Czechoslovakia or Czechia now, and Slovakia. I always forget when I'm, you know, I've been reading some World War II books recently. It's all blurring together, so apologies for that. But yeah, so they're kind of in, They kind of mostly spread out along rivers, especially in what is now southern and central Germany. And they kind of move up from there. And they occupy all of kind of the headwaters of the major German rivers, as well as, you know, some smaller ones, the Elbe, the Oder, the Weser, the Rhine. Those rivers are very important for travel and trade and for establishing, viable, useful agricultural settlements. Because remember, the LBK people are descendants of one of the early waves of Anatolian farmer migrations into Europe. They're moving land. They're moving through the land and along river valleys, whereas the Cardium ware culture is moving via the sea and the oceans. The LBK never establishes themselves along the coast. And we'll get into that, why that happens, or why we, the theories about why that happens. That's kind of tie into maybe the end of the LBK. But for now, let's go ahead and kind of refocus and start talking about the LBK, how they changed in Central and Western Europe, and what potentially led to their eventual replacement by their several regional successor cultures in the West. Also, I will not be re-going over their pottery that we've kind of already discussed to a decent extent. I will have a couple of examples again, but just know that they're still continuing to produce pottery with the linear lines etched on them. They do continue to kind of innovate in terms of shape and size. They keep creating new types of, bowls and things like that, and carrying, vessels, all that kind of stuff. That's regional, different designs emerge in different areas, but they all typically have that kind of linear etching, divots in the pottery. That's not unique at any of these, sites. The decoration isn't unique. Different areas have different types of shapes and sizes, but there's back and forth on that, and some regions will, certain designs will fall out of favor in one place, and then another place will kind of pick it up later. Just wanted to keep that out there. Also, for their homes, I know I posted the longhouse images. But there were some things I did forget to mention, I think, on that prior episode. So I wanted to go in a little bit more detail on the longhouses. Now, I talked about the length and the kind of the width of the longhouses and, potentially how many people could have lived in those. Some of the longhouses, when I mentioned that, and this came to my mind too, you think of a square or a rectangle. For a longhouse, a perfect rectangle. However, that is not always the case for the LBK longhouses. Some of them did have more curved sides on some of their longhouses. Like if you enter in the front where it's kind of a flat square surface with a door, as you go further back, sometimes they narrow as you go deeper into the longhouse. Also, the LBK settlements vary in some cases very wildly, how many longhouses you'll see at a site. Some could have quite a few. Some would just have one longhouse with a couple of other smaller houses kind of dotting the area around it. And these were typically smaller, circular, or in some cases kind of square houses. It could vary from region to region. And the houses themselves typically were divided in terms of what their uses were for. You kind of had an area at the front where it was maybe like a quarter to a third In some cases, even less than that. And then you have your central area, which is kind of a more living area or work area where people were creating, stone tools, pottery, grinding flour to create food. And then you'd have an area further back that might be for storage or things like that. And in some areas that would be some places that would be the sleeping quarters. But then there are other places that the LBK where they actually had like a second floor over the work area, and that would be where people slept. Not necessarily strictly uniform in terms of shape and size, but they all kind of had the same interior. So this is a little bit kind of a precursor to what the Romans would call a domus, for like a larger kind of community. Also, another thing I did not point out, and this does tie in to the longhouse structure, at least for the LBK, it also throws kind of some water on, some of the matriarchal dominated discussion, which again, that's other stuff we're going to get into. The LBK do appear to have had a division of labor between men and women, and they can tell this from like occupational markers on the skeletons. Older individuals, if they keep doing repetitive tasks, they'll wear their bones in certain ways. It does look like the women were mostly responsible for creating pottery. So a lot, if not, most of the pottery that we have found would have been created by women. Women were also the ones typically grinding the grain. And also you can see that with the grave goods. Now, the LBK didn't necessarily include a lot of grave goods with their dead, but that is something as time goes on that does increase. Women would be buried with things that they worked with in their life, and they also are the ones that typically have the shell headdresses, necklaces, polished bracelets, things like that. Men, on the other hand, were typically buried with stone tools, adzes that they would use to work the land, work wood, and of course they were buried with polished stone, axes, mace heads, things like that, things that they would have used in life. So there is a very strong division of labor. Another thing that kind of, works into that is that they've done like isotopic analysis of, a lot of skeletons, and it does appear that men mostly lived and died in the same general area that they were born. Men were not very mobile for the most part, whereas women, they had a little bit more mobility. So that does seem to suggest that men typically inherited land from their fathers or, other male relatives, perhaps an uncle, something along those lines, or grandfather. And the women would be traded or, married off to neighboring villages, maybe two valleys over or between the marshlands or, the mountains, places like that. So there does to be some, they do appear to be patrilocal as opposed to matrilocal, which if you remember, we talked about matriarchies in that episode we were talking about in East Asia and the different versions of, what a matriarchy could be and matrilocal versus patrilocal. That kind of ties into that as well. So that, that does kind of, it kind of separates the LBK at least from some of the other Neolithic early agricultural sites that we've discussed in other areas. Now, another thing with the LBK that we discussed when we first introduced them is that they are mixing, at least on a little bit of a level, with the Western hunter-gatherer peoples already living in the region. There's a little bit more evidence of early admixture between Western hunter-gatherers and Anatolian farmers than what you see immediately in the Balkans and Greece, as well as the Cardiomere places. This is happening very early on. And you can see that at some of the LBK settlements. In addition to the longhouses I mentioned, some settlements would have one or two smaller houses around them. Well, you also see that there is kind of a divide between the peoples living in the longhouse and people living in the houses on the exterior. There are medium-sized homes where individuals would have a little bit of land for agriculture, but they were also hunting, as well as eating some domesticated animals. Whereas the longhouse peoples, they were growing a lot more crops and eating a lot more domesticated animals and very little wild animals. And then you even have some very small houses where they're not growing any, there's no evidence of any crops being grown on the area around it. There's no grain or anything like that in those homes, but there is evidence of hunting wild animals like boar, and they may have had some domesticated pigs, but there's no evidence of any kind of agriculture at the smaller homes. But they were creating things like leather. So, you know, there might have been some level of, you know, patronage, for lack of a better term, where, you know, these hunter-gatherers living on the outskirts of the longhouse may have been trading leather or wild game with the people in the longhouses, but it's hard to see that that's exactly, you know, extremely beneficial to the hunter-gatherers. They're very limited in what they're getting, at least from what we can tell, from the peoples in the longhouses. Now, I should point out that that's not apparent at all LBK sites. That's some of the ones that we've... I think there was only really one or two places that that's especially noticeable. I think it was a location in France. So this is kind of the western terminus of the LBK horizon. But, you know, it does show that, you know, maybe these early interactions or the earlier interactions between hunter-gatherers and LBK people was not necessarily, you know, a mutually beneficial. It could have been, you know, weighted much more heavily in the agricultural direction than it could have been in the hunter-gatherer direction. Which, you know, is a little odd because the farmers are using different land than the other nearby hunter-gatherer groups are. They're actually in Central Europe and to the north and again to the coasts. A lot of the hunter-gatherers, you know, really embraced fishing. So they're using the marshland and things like that a lot more. And they're seasonal, they're mobile, they're moving from region to region as time goes on. So it's hard to say why you have, you know, this kind of, at least in this one region, why that they have these hunter-gatherers in these settlements. Again, it's not really kind of beneficial to a hunter-gatherer to remain in an area for any extended period of time. So that is a little bit of a mystery. But again, you only really see it kind of at the very western edge of the LBK horizon. Now, because of the, I guess, the organization, or at least it's theorized because of the organization, these longhouses kind of were the centers of the community. However, some of the larger communities with multiple longhouses, you know, there does seem to be kind of a competition in some places for longhouses to be built bigger and better. They do begin to expand as time goes on. And a longhouse is really only kept standing for about 30 years or so. At least that's what archaeologists believe. The longhouses lasted around 30 years or so. At that point, they are abandoned and torn down, and they're never reoccupied. But in a lot of places, you know, newer longhouses are built nearby. So it's thought that perhaps when the leading person in a longhouse died, you know, they, you know, may have, the home may have been abandoned by their children, and then those children would either expand out, found a new settlement, build their own longhouse, or they may have built, you know, new longhouses nearby. But there does appear to have been kind of like a moratorium on rebuilding over these old longhouses. And, you know, that's probably part of the reason why the LBK expands so quickly. That and, you know, there not being a comparable number of hunter-gatherers that they're having to compete with for agricultural land. Though, of course, they would have to compete for maybe areas where agriculturalists would be grazing their herds. That may be driving away the wild animals, or there may have been conflict over, you know, hunter-gatherers killing domesticated animals because they're, you know, easy marks, but the hunter-gatherer population density isn't really something that the agriculturists would necessarily have to worry about, at least in general. Though I'm sure there are some areas where the agriculturists were probably heavily outnumbered. And you can maybe see that in some of the later LBK sites. As more and more land is taken up by agriculturalists, you do begin to see the longhouses and their surrounding smaller homes and domiciles are beginning to be fortified. Walls are being built around them, ditches are being dug, and things like that. Now, there is some debate if these are true defensive fortifications or if it's just, you know, some type of ritual location, if these were kind of big meeting halls for extended families to come and, you know, commune and reaffirm bonds, things like that, if there was some type of religious component there. And there are places where this could certainly be true. There is a place in, I believe it's called the Gossek Circle, and this is in the modern area of Saxony-Anhalt in Germany, where it is just like a 75-diameter circle where they had dual rings of wooden palisades, and they kind of had like a, kind of an embankment leading up into this little divot where, the, again, these two circular palisade walls were built, and then had the singular entrance. So that really wouldn't have been useful for, you know, defensive purposes. It was more like a giant corral, essentially. But, you know, some of these other LBK sites, they would have been useful defensive settlements. So there may have been a mixture of those usages in some of the sites. Now, as for the end of the LBK, that kind of starts right around 5100, 5000 BC, give or take. The dates are a little bit debated. Also, different areas, this is maybe happening at a different time. But at least in what is now central Germany, right around 5,100, 5,000, again, give or take a 100 years or so, one way or the other, you begin to see large-scale LBK sites disappearing. The populations drop. Some sites you see evidence of massacres of quite a number of people. And their bodies are typically just dumped in, you know, big ditches or, you know, burial pits, things like that. And most of these remains that have been found are male. I think upwards of, I think it's around 80% in some areas, in some places it's entirely male. And, you know, you might find one or two female skeletons in some of the places. However, the ones that have been found are generally older. At least they appear to be more elderly women. So that tends to say that the younger women and girls are being taken by the people performing these massacres. Now, why this is happening, it's hard to say. It does appear that there may have been some type of climatic downturn in terms of the weather. It may have gotten a lot colder a lot earlier or for a lot longer period in the region for whatever reason. There also could have just been lack of usable soil or arable soil. Remember, this is before large-scale crop rotation, things like that. The land could have just reached its carrying capacity. They could have, experienced some type of disease outbreak that really cut down the numbers to make, farming the land viable. They could have run out of labor. It could have been a combination of all these factors, as well as other things, adding on to that. It's really hard to say for sure. But the large-scale trade links from, the various LBK sites from one end of the horizon to the other break down. There's less interaction with their neighbors to the south and Italy and France and the Balkans. That kind of goes away. So these kind of, reciprocal trading ventures disappear too. So something causes a large number of these sites to collapse or disappear or be destroyed. And it is being destroyed, at least from what we can tell in the evidence, in the center part of their lands, it is being destroyed by other LBK peoples. So there does appear to be an element of regionalism causing this violence. However, there is also evidence that in their western and northern, very northern extremes, again, kind of on that area with Denmark, as well as what is now Normandy, Brittany, and along the coast of Belgium and the Netherlands, that there is also violent raids and things like that incoming from the hunting-gatherer peoples that were their neighbors. So they had enemies both within and without of their traditional or historic borders. Now, this period of violence lasts different periods, but essentially, once it's over, there are kind of eight kind of sub-LBK groups left, or descendants of the LBK, or at least inherited some level of their traditions and economy from the LBK. Again, in the West and in the far North, there's a question of, is this truly an LBK settlement, or is this the hunter-gatherers just kind of incorporating former LBK practices into their own ways of life. The eight kind of outgrowths of the LBK, they're very widespread. You have the Lingil in what is now mostly Austria, parts of Hungary. You have the Stroke pottery culture, which is on the most of their sites are kind of centered around the southern Elba and Oder, though they do have a couple of western kind of locations as well. There's also overlap between the Stroke pottery and it's the Oberlauterbach. Then there is overlap between the Oberlauterbach and the Grossgartach, and I know I'm butchering that. Apologies to any of my German listeners. And the Grossgartach overlap with some Rossen sites, and the Rossen overlap with some Stroke pottery sites. And then you have in the very far west, along the Seine River, actually, in what is now Paris, you have the Villeneuve-Saint-Germain kind of breakaway cultures. And then there are also a couple of sites in in Poland. And there's a lot of overlap between those sites and the Stroke Pottery. These are the, and I'm going to butcher this because it's a Polish term, the Brzezik Kujawski culture. And there are other regional cultures as well. These are typically a little bit smaller. Some of the names are different depending on the source you read, but there's a lot of overlap. There's also the Mikulsburg culture, and that has a lot of overlap with the Rossen and the Grosskartakt. When the LBK falls apart, it leaves a lot of division among their former sites. You also have to the north, and this includes, you know, areas that we talked about with the Stroke Pottery and, the Rossen culture. There is also what's known as the Funnel Beaker culture. But that is one of the ones that is kind of an offshoot of hunter-gatherers moving in. They were preceded by another Mesolithic hunter-gatherer culture known as the Utabula. And we'll talk about them when we talk about Denmark, and then we'll, of course, refer to the funnel beaker culture. And then there are, again, some cultures in the West that were taken over by Mesolithic hunter-gatherers. And that's also happened in Iberia, too. There were Mesolithic hunter-gatherers, and they began to kind of take over some of those La Almagra sites, as well as parts of, I think, northwest Iberia as well. But that's all stuff we'll cover. We'll cover the regions, those other regions, as we move forward. We'll kind of, the Iberia and the France ones we'll cover as kind of their own section. So that'll be probably on the next episode or the episode after. Though I should also point out that, again, some of these regional cultures are very small. They only have, you know, maybe a handful of settlements, like two or three, like major ones, and then, you know, a bunch of smaller villages. But then you also have some sites that do continue just the traditional LBK. They don't really have anything that belongs to any of those other cultures. They are just continuing this kind of traditional LBK art style and longhouse organization until about 4,500, at which point they are either completely abandoned or they are subsumed by one of the successor cultures that we just mentioned. And, this is already at half an hour. I was going to go in a little bit more detail, but, considering the episode's length and all that kind of stuff, I might go ahead and call it here for tonight, and then we'll kind of go into a little bit more detail on this on the next episode, and that may give me a good bit to talk about without having to do a huge amount of research during the week next week. Apologies for the cut there. The ambulances were getting closer. I didn't want to deafen you guys too much with that. So yeah, I think this is a good place to call it. I still do plan on taking either the weekend after, so this next week off after Christmas, or the following week after New Year's. I'm not sure which week yet, but either way, that'll help me with having to do research during that period. I'll be a little bit less pressed for time, for organization, and all that kind of stuff. So I am going to go ahead and call the episode here. I do appreciate you guys for listening. Please be sure, again, to rate, like, download, subscribe, all that kind of good stuff. Whatever your platform of choice asks you to do. If you have any questions, comments, constructive criticism, please let me know. You can reach me at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can also contact me via direct message on X/Twitter. And if you follow me on YouTube, you can leave a comment there. I also stream during the week and sometimes on the weekends. If you see I'm live, you're welcome to come in and say hey. Yeah. Appreciate you all. It's going to be a busy week for a lot of people coming up. And, of course, the week after is probably going to be busy, too. What with the new year and all that kind of stuff. So, I hope you all have a pleasant holidays. And I will see you on the next episode. And until then, peace.